continues to expand their green tech portfolio. K.R. Sridhar accelerated the development of the intellectual assets of this company by getting rid of the prima donna who is impeding the intelligence of the whole organization. A CEO of a $3 billion consumer products firm was leading his management team through an important product pricing decision that had the potential to generate profits that would fund much-needed R&D expenditures. One member of the management team, Ron, was reluctant to let go of the current model and to support the direction of the team. After a series of management meetings to debate the issues, it came down to a moment of truth decision in an important executive staff meeting. Prior to the meeting, the CEO pulled Ron aside and asked frankly, "If the team wants to move forward with the pricing change, will you let go of your position against this and support a new model?" Ron agreed that he would support the new direction. However, during the staff meeting, Ron again dug in his heels, telling the group, "My team simply won't support this new pricing model." There was a silent exasperation in the room as the team could see that their ideas and energy were being blocked once again. The CEO stopped the meeting and asked Ron to step outside. He took him about 40 yards down the hall to his office, and he fired him, right there on the spot. As he walked back to the conference room, the CEO wondered if he had acted too fast and if this move would throw off the team. He re-entered the conference room and told them. Instead of concern, he could see relief on their faces. One executive team member said, "Look, if anything, I think you waited too long." Is it possible that your smartest people may be impeding the smarts of your organization? And is it possible you are waiting too long to remove the blockers? Get out of the way. Sometimes a talent magnet removes the prima donna who is blocking the intelligence of others, but sometimes the blocker is the leader, him or herself. C.K. Prahalad, management guru and one of my mentors, once shared with me an old saying in India, "Nothing grows under a banyan tree. It provides shade and is comfortable, but it allows no sun in for growth." Many leaders are banyan trees. They protect their people, but nothing grows under them. One corporate VP had a favorite saying, quoted often and written on her door, "Ignore me as needed to get your job done." This simple mantra signaled an important trust in the judgment and capability of others. Her people knew that exercising their judgment and getting the job done rapidly was more important than placating the boss. She told new staff members, "Yes, there will be a few times when I get agitated because I would have done it differently, but I'll get over it. I'd rather you trust your judgment, keep moving, and get the job done." Talent magnets remove the barriers that block the growth of intelligence in their people. The world of the talent magnet is dynamic. Talent is drawn in by the strong gravitational pull of the talent magnet. It is then fully utilized, stretched, made continually ready for new challenges. Life with an empire builder doesn't offer the same thrill ride. It is a world of politics, ownership, and limitations. The diminisher's approach to managing talent. Multipliers operate from a belief that talent exists everywhere, and they can use it at its highest if they can simply identify the genius in people. Diminishers think, people need to report to me in order to get them to do anything. One such senior director said the only thing that was wrong with the underperforming IT division was that it reported to someone else. He saw owning the resources himself as the primary solution. Diminishers are owners of talent, not developers of talent. Because they don't actively develop talent, people in their organizations languish and can actually regress. Acquire resources. Empire builders focus their energy on acquiring resources and slotting them into organizational structures where they are visible and clearly under the command of the leader. For some leaders, this amassing of talent can become an obsession. Recall Jasper Wallace, the high-cost diminisher from the first chapter, who was obsessed with the size of his organization relative to those of his peers on the executive team. After years of building his organization with his right hand while masking the underlying problems with his left hand, Jasper succeeded in building an empire complete with a separate office tower, customer visit center, and training campus just for his division. However, his organization had become gangly after such rapid, unrestrained growth and created additional problems of integration and coordination. The hole became deeper and deeper until the division was radically scaled back and folded into another group. Like ancient Rome, the empire eventually got overextended and collapsed under its own weight. Put people in boxes. Divide and conquer is the modus operandi of empire builders. They bring in great talent and carve out a fiefdom for them, but they don't encourage people to step beyond these walls. Rather than give broad scope to their management team, empire builders ensure that they themselves are the point of integration. You can often spot an empire builder because he or she either operates exclusively through one-on-one meetings or runs staff meetings as an official report out from each fiefdom. One manager was known for making key decisions one-on-one rather than with his team. This fostered a covert and high-stakes game among his lieutenants. Each of them would vie for the coveted one-on-one meeting time, the last meeting on a Friday afternoon. Why? Because everyone knew that he made his decisions by himself over the weekend and announced them in his staff meeting on Monday. People quickly learned that the person who got his ear last on Friday afternoon would have the most influence. His divide-and-conquer approach not only kept people in narrowly defined roles, it was a dangerous and costly way to make decisions. Let talent languish. One way empire builders stifle their talent is by hogging the limelight for themselves. They are often the prima donna, insisting that they get maximum time on the stage and that scripts are written to feature them. Whereas talent magnates give credit, empire builders take credit. Hogging the limelight is an active way empire builders hold others back, but the more insidious problem is actually what they don't do. These managers actively acquire talent, but then are passive about growing it. They are, for the most part, oblivious to the development of others. In fact, in our quantitative research, we found that develops the talent of the team was among the lowest three skills of the diminisher. They also stifle talent because they don't clear away the dead wood. One diminisher we studied was notorious for draining his organization through his inaction. People said, he and his management team never made decisions. They didn't make waves. They just kept analyzing. Instead of firing toxic or ineffective leaders, he would slowly disable them. One observer noted, it was torture to watch one of his staff get cut off. It was like a child pulling off the legs of a spider one by one and then watching it hobble away. When leaders play the role of the empire builder, they bring in great resources, but they underutilize them because they fundamentally undervalue them. They continue to operate in a one-brain, many-hands organizational model that stunts the growth of both intelligence and talent around them. Diminishers build organizations where people go to die. This is why diminishers are costly to organizations. The assets in their portfolio don't increase in value. Leveraging talent. Marguerite Hancock, the girls' camp director discussed earlier, is known for getting the maximum effort from her team. Not only does she attract and develop a team of A players, this university professor researcher expects A work from everyone. She isn't shy about asking others to do the really tough stuff. One team member said, "She asks you to do really hard things, but she makes it an act of service, not servitude. And she fully expects you to ask other people to do hard things, too." Under Marguerite's leadership, people say they execute to the maximum and do things they never thought they could do. When girls' camp is over each year, her fellow leaders confess to feeling a certain relief it has done. But they say, "I feel like all that effort was worth it. I'm absolutely exhausted, but I am ready to do it again." A players delivering A work, exhausted but ready to do it again. This is the way of the talent magnet. This is how, under their leadership, smart people get smarter. Talent magnets go beyond attracting smart people into the organization. They also draw out that talent by connecting people with opportunities that allow them to operate at their highest point of contribution. The following information reflects why empire builders leave capability on the table while talent magnets create and grow intelligence all around them. Empire builders. What they do. Hoard resources and underutilize talent. empire builders, what they get. A reputation as the person A players should avoid working for, the place you go to die. Underutilized people whose capability atrophies. Disillusioned A players who don't reach out to other A players. A stagnation of talent where disillusioned A players quit and stay. Talent magnets, what they do. Attract talent and deploy it at its highest point of contribution. Talent magnets, what they get. A reputation as the person A players should work for, the place you go to grow. Fully utilized people whose genius continues to expand. Inspired A players who attract other A players into the organization. A flow of A players attracting other A players as they then move up and out of the organization. Becoming a talent magnet. The promise of a multiplier is that they get twice the capacity plus a growth dividend from their people as their genius expands under the leadership of the multiplier. Let's now look at a few starting points for becoming a talent magnet. The starting block. Become a genius watcher. Todd Paletta, a retailing executive and aspiring multiplier, had just finished an exhausting business meeting in New York and settled into his business class seat, headed for home on the West Coast. As the plane took off, he heard the cry of a baby. He hoped it would stop after the plane settled into the standard cruising altitude of 30,000 feet. It didn't. He then realized the sound was right behind him, right there in business class. A baby in business class. The mother stood up in the aisle, trying to console the child. Now the jarring sound was right next to his ear. Todd was annoyed at first, but as his attention became focused on the mother, he started genius watching. He found himself studying her actions closely and appreciating her efforts to soothe the child. He observed the way she juggled the demands of the child and the silent frustrations of the other passengers. He watched longer and noticed her patience. He began talking with her, learning more about her, her efforts, and her interests. He started forming hypotheses about her talents and perhaps even a source of her genius. He then started to wonder, if she worked on my team, how would I put these abilities to use? Where would she excel? No, Todd didn't make a job offer to this mother during the flight or after. The point is that Todd was learning to genius watch and was practicing it in even the most unusual of places and circumstances. He had spent the last 2 weeks studying the capabilities of the people in his organization, looking to identify their native genius and how he might best utilize it in his business. He was in genius watching mode, and he couldn't help but see it everywhere, even in the efforts of a mother with an inconsolable child and a plane full of aggravated passengers. Here are 3 steps to help you begin genius watching. 1. Identify it. Make a list of 8 to 10 people you work with closely. Start to note the things they do both easily and freely. Go beyond surface-level skills like, she is an Excel spreadsheet wizard. If you need help finding the underlying capabilities, ask why about 3 times until you find the underlying capability that allows someone to do some activity well. For example, Susan may appear to be an Excel wizard on the surface, but perhaps it is because she is good at modeling data. And perhaps she is good at modeling data because she has a genius for critical thinking. 2. Test it. Once you've developed a hypothesis about each person, test out your thinking and refine your views. Ask a colleague if he thinks critical thinking is one of Susan's geniuses. Test the idea with Susan herself. Ask her what she is good at and what she wants to further excel at. 3. Work it. Once you've found a native genius for someone, make a list of 5 different roles you could put this person in that would utilize and expand this genius. If Susan is a financial analyst, what other roles could you put her in that would draw upon her intelligence for critical thinking? Perhaps she'd be good in a strategy role or on the marketing competitive intelligence team. Go beyond formal jobs and identify ad hoc roles. Perhaps Susan would be good at reviewing an important presentation that you are making to the board of directors to find holes or inconsistencies. Or maybe she should be assigned to a task force to pick the location of the next offshore R&D center. Just as the talent magnet looks for talent beyond organizational boundaries, look for jobs and roles both inside and outside of your organization. Pull some weeds. Individual genius can be deceptive. At first look, it would appear costly to remove one super smart player, even if she has a diminishing effect on a team. But one needs only to do the math to see the high cost of destructive genius. Our research consistently confirmed that diminishers cause people to operate at about 50% of their full intelligence and capability. Removing a highly intelligent employee or leader can be difficult, but it can have huge payoffs. On a work team of 11 people, removing a diminisher can give back the equivalent of 5 full-time people, with 10 people operating at 100%. You may lose one mind, but you gain back 5. It is a law of numbers. Leaders most often know who the blockers are. The most common mistake they make is waiting too long to remove them. If you want to unleash the talent that is latent in your organization, find the weeds and pull them out. Don't do it quietly. Like K.R. Sridhar and the CEO described earlier, huddle the team immediately and let them know that you've removed someone because he or she was holding back the team. Give people permission to think fully again. Each of the above is a starting point that can create a proof point for the power of the talent magnet. Once successful, you will be one step further along the path of the multiplier. Up and to the right. Sue Siegel, former president of Affymetrics and an extraordinary multiplier, reflected on her pillar experiences as a leader. She said, "My best moments were when team members would call me after accomplishing some tough goal or overcoming a huge hurdle. They were usually tired, but they were brimming with enthusiasm, having grown through the challenge. These moments were exhilarating for them and me." The people who worked for Sue indeed described the time as a highlight of their career. Talent magnets encourage people to grow and leave. They write letters of recommendation, and they help people find their next stage to perform on. And when people leave their group, they celebrate their departures and shout their success to everyone. You see, these celebrations become their best recruiting tool. Jack and Susie Welch wrote, "The best thing about being a preferred employer is that it gets you good people, and this launches a virtuous cycle. The best team attracts the best team, and winning often leads to more winning. That's a ride that you and your employees will never want to get off." Talent magnets create a cycle of attraction that is exhilarating for employer and employee alike. Their organizations are coveted places of employment, and people flock to work for them, knowing the talent magnet will stretch them, grow them, and accelerate their careers. It is a thrill ride with the speed and exhilaration of a roller coaster, but one that, like the revenue chart of every CFO's dreams, moves constantly up and to the right. Chapter 2 Summary. The Multiplier Formula. The Empire Builder versus the Talent Magnet. Empire builders bring in great talent, but they underutilize it because they hoard resources and use them only for their own gain. Talent magnets get access to the best talent because people flock to work for them, knowing they will be fully utilized and developed to be ready for the next stage. The four practices of the talent magnet. 1. Look for talent everywhere. Appreciate all types of genius. Ignore boundaries. 2. Find people's native genius. Look for what is native. Label it. 3. Utilize people to their fullest. Connect people with opportunities. Shine a spotlight. 4. Remove the blockers. Get rid of prima donnas. Get out of the way. Becoming a talent magnet. 1. Become a genius watcher. 2. Pull some weeds. Unexpected findings. 1. Both talent magnets and empire builders attract A talent. What differentiates them is what they do with the talent once it's in their door. 2. Talent magnets don't run out of talent by moving their people on to bigger, better opportunities, because there is a steady stream of talent wanting to get into their organization.
Chapter 3. The Liberator. The only freedom that is of enduring importance is the freedom of intelligence, that is to say, freedom of observation and of judgment. John Dewey.
Michael Chang began his career in a small consulting company. As a young manager, he was forceful with his opinion and erred toward brutal honesty. Over time, he saw its damaging effects and reflected, "It certainly doesn't get people to blossom." As Michael gained leadership experience, he began to realize that when you become the leader, the center of gravity is no longer yourself. He had a mentor who taught him that the leader's job is to put other people on stage. He began to shift his focus to others, and he became less controlling and learned to give people space. Where he used to jump in and do it for them, he learned to hold back. He found that not only do other people step up, they often surprise you by producing something better than you would have. As he has grown as a leader, he's learned to be direct without being destructive. He's learned how to create an environment where he could tell the truth and have others grow from it. Today, this manager is the CEO of a thriving startup company. He has developed several practices that give space for others to do their best work. He makes a conscious effort to create a learning environment by recruiting people with a strong learning orientation and then often admitting his own mistakes. This gives others permission to make and recover from their own mistakes. When offering his opinion, he distinguishes hard opinions from soft opinions. Soft opinions signal to his team, "Here are some ideas for you to consider in your own thinking." Hard opinions are reserved for times when he holds a very strong view. Here's a leader who began his career headed down the path of a management tyrant, but who has become a multiplier and liberator himself. The accomplishment is significant when you consider the path of least resistance for most smart, driven leaders is to become a tyrant. Even Michael said, "It's not like it isn't tempting to be tyrannical when you can." Let's face it, corporate environments and modern organizations are the perfect setup for diminishing leadership and have a certain built-in tyranny. The org charts, the hierarchy, the titles, the approval matrixes skew power toward the top and create incentives for people to shut down and comply. In any hierarchical organization, the playing field is rarely level. The senior leaders stand on the high side of the field, and ideas and policies roll easily down to the lower side. Policies established to create order often unintentionally keep people from thinking. At best, these policies limit intellectual range of motion as they straitjacket the thinking of the followers. At worst, these systems shut down thinking entirely. These hierarchical structures make it easy for tyrants to reign. And in their reign, these managers can easily suppress and constrain the thinking of the people around them. Consider the fate of Kate, a corporate manager who began her career as an intelligent, driven, and creative collaborator. She was promoted into management and moved quickly from frontline manager to vice president and is now running a large organization. She still sees herself as an open-minded, creative thought leader. But in a recent 360-degree feedback report, she was shocked to find that her people don't seem to agree. As she read the report, she could see that her strong ideas were hampering the creativity and capability of her people. And her drive for results was making it difficult for people to be truthful and take risks. One of the comments read, "It is just easier to hold back and let Kate do the thinking." Kate was stunned. Every step she had taken up the corporate ladder made it that much easier for her to unintentionally kill other people's ideas. The nature of the hierarchy had skewed power, making every conversation Kate had with a subordinate inherently unequal. The playing field was tilted in her favor. An off-the-cuff remark could be translated as a strong opinion and turned into policy for her division. If she rolled her eyes or sighed sharply after someone's comment, everyone in the room noticed and avoided saying anything they thought would produce the same reaction. She had more power than she had realized. She had become an accidental diminisher. I suspect I saw too many military movies in college because they all started to look alike. Inevitably, there would be a scene where an army private who was privy to some debacle would stand at attention and nervously appeal to the commanding officer, "Permission to speak freely, sir?" I could never understand this strange custom and why someone would need permission to speak freely. After all, I was in college where thinking and speaking freely was the norm. However, after several years in the workplace, I clearly understood. Formal hierarchies suppress the voices and often ideas of those at the bottom. Multipliers liberate people from the oppressive forces within corporate hierarchy. They liberate people to think, to speak, and to act with reason. They create an environment where the best ideas surface and where people do their best work. They give people permission to think. The tyrant versus the liberator. Multipliers create an intense environment in which superior thinking and work can flourish. Tyrants create a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capability. A tense leader. Jenna Healy was an SVP of field operations for a large telecommunications company. She was a serious leader who, even at 5'3", had a way of towering over the people who worked for her. Jenna was a smart manager with strong experience, but Jenna was an absolute tyrant. Her colleague said, "She created an environment of hysteria. She created fear all around her and intimidated and bullied people until she got what she wanted. Her primary approach to leadership was, 'What more can you do for me?' When one of her managers said, 'She's a bit like the ruthless Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada,' I got the picture immediately." Not only was Jenna a bully, but she struck at random. It was hard to predict what would set her off or who would be the next victim. One person recalled, "You felt like you could be the next guy. I was stressed, on the edge, and at risk around her." Her colleagues joked, "There needs to be a storm warning system for Jenna. People need to know when it is time to duck and cover." Jenna's quarterly management meeting in Denver was one such time. Jenna had gathered a cross-functional team to review the state of the business in the U.S. market. It was a typical business review, with each function in turn presenting its state of the business. After several presentations, Daniel, the manager of the information technology team, began his presentation by showing the managers the data for how their field service staff was utilizing the IT tools that his team had built for them. He then inquired, "In light of these numbers, I wonder if the service teams are taking advantage of the tools that already exist." Based on Jenna's reaction, you would have thought he had just told her that her team was stupid and lazy. She snapped, "You have no idea what you are talking about," and then berated him in front of the group. The argument got heated and lasted for an uncomfortable 10 minutes. When somebody finally signaled that the group was overdue for a break, there was a rapid dash for the conference room door. But Daniel stayed in an attempt to hold his ground against Jenna. With everyone out in the hall, the argument escalated irrationally and turned to shouting. While things were heated in the conference room, outside in the hall, there was a distinct chill in the air. Everyone in the hall was quietly cheering Daniel for standing up to the bully, but those who were next up to present were frozen with fear. You could feel the tension. The fortunate ones who had already given their presentations wished luck to their ill-fated colleagues. These remaining presenters began scrambling to adjust their presentations, taking out anything controversial that might incite the already livid leader. The presenters watered down their presentations, and they got through the meeting, but nothing much was really said, and nothing much was accomplished. Jenna's organization made some modest progress, but continually failed to hit its revenue and service quality targets. Eventually, when she went too far and bullied one of their partners, she was exited instantly from the organization. Jenna went to another company as COO. She lasted 2 weeks before being demoted. 6 months later, she was asked to leave. People hold back around leaders like Jenna. Such tyrants shut down the flow of intelligence and rarely access people's best work. Everywhere they go, they find people doing less than they really can. It is no wonder they resort to intimidation, thinking it will get them what they no doubt want, great thinking and great work. But intimidation and fear rarely produce truly great work. Let's look at another senior sales and services leader. An intense leader. Robert Enslin is the president of SAP North America, the global software giant. Originally from South Africa, he speaks with a calm confidence. Robert is highly respected with a reputation as a fair, consistent sales leader who grows organizations and delivers results. Robert operates as a peer to everyone he works with and is accessible to all. One of his managers said of him, "He is very good at disarming you. He is a commoner, one of us. Even if you work three levels below him, he still wants to know what you think." As a result, people are more transparent around him. They don't feel like they have to tell him what he wants to hear. This approachability creates safety for the people around Robert, and that safety is what allows him to run a massive sales organization with no surprises. Several years ago, Robert was asked to take over the Japanese subsidiary for SAP to address some very specific sales performance issues. When he met with his new leadership team in Japan for the first forecast meeting, he could see the forecasting process was in complete disarray. Instead of playing the authoritarian, judging their failure and dictating his solution, Robert restrained himself and started a learning process. He helped them realize the limitations of the current process and the advantages of a new approach. He then drew on their knowledge of the Japanese business and asked them, "How can we take this to the next level?" He created space for the team to try new approaches and fix the problem themselves. He stayed with them on the issue for months until they could run a forecast process that delivered solid, predictable results for the business. Robert was known for his collegial approach and his calm consistency, but this was tested when he took over the North American business in 2008, just as the global economy was melting down. As spending was locked up and large capital purchases were being put on hold, executives everywhere were beginning to panic. You could feel the tension as you walked through the halls of SAP's Newtown Square office near Philadelphia. One step past the glass door, you could feel the tension as you entered the executive conference room. Inside another conference room, Robert and his new management team were assembled to plan their sales strategy in this new economic environment. Every person on his team knew that Robert had been meeting with the senior executives and was under a lot of pressure. They came to the meeting prepared to feel their share of the pain. After all, this was a sales organization. But Robert was calm and constant, even amid this chaos. His team began to wonder if he hadn't been reading the news or had skipped the executive meetings. He opened the meeting by acknowledging the severity of the economic issues, but suggested they put them aside. He kept the team focused on the issues within their control. He then asked, "What can we do to differentiate ourselves right now?" Safe within their sphere of expertise and control, the group worked to identify the value proposition that would help them position their solutions in the turbulent climate. After the discussion, he then asked, "How can we help people consume our products so they get the most economic value?" Again, the group could wrestle this question down and put together a plan. His team said, "We know he must have been getting pressure from up higher, but he didn't create anxiety for us. He remained calm and just never wigged out. He doesn't create whiplash for his people." Robert's calmness is not synonymous with softness. He is as intense and focused as any other successful sales executive. The difference is where his focus lies. A member of his leadership team said, "With Robert, it isn't about him. He makes it about you and about getting the best work from you." Robert's steady hand and open environment provide sanity and stability to an organization that could have easily spun into crisis. Tense versus intense. Tyrants create a tense environment, one that is full of stress and anxiety. Liberators like Robert create an intense environment that requires concentration, diligence, and energy. It is an environment where people are encouraged to think for themselves, but also where people experience a deep obligation to do their best work. Diminishers create a stress-filled environment because they don't give people control over their own performance. They operate as tyrants, overexerting their will on the organization. They cause others to shrink, retreat, and hold back. In the presence of a tyrant, people try not to stand out. Just consider how people operate under the rule of a political dictator. Tyrants get diminished thinking from others because people only offer the safest ideas and mediocre work. While a tyrant creates stress that causes people to hold back, a liberator creates space for people to step up. While a tyrant swings between positions that create whiplash in the organization, a liberator builds stability that generates forward momentum. The liberator. The liberator creates an environment where good things happen. They create the conditions where intelligence is engaged, grown, and transformed into concrete successes. What are the conditions for this cycle of learning and success? They might include: ideas are generated with ease. People learn rapidly and adapt to new environments. People work collaboratively. Complex problems get solved. Difficult tasks get accomplished. Let's examine three liberators from very different industries who created these conditions and freed their organizations to think and to perform. Liberator number one, equity in the firm. Ernest Bachrach from Argentina is the managing partner and co-head of Latin America for Advent International, a global private equity firm. With 27 years of experience in international private equity and an MBA from Harvard University, Ernest is clearly an expert. But the source of his genius is the environment he creates to unleash the genius of his organization. One of his analysts described his approach. Ernest makes a conscious effort to create an environment. He creates forums for people to voice their ideas, but he holds a very high bar for what you must do before you voice an opinion. You need to have the data. He has a problem with opinions without data. Ernest builds a learning machine in his organization. When he discovers performance problems, he is quick to give feedback. The feedback is direct and sometimes harsh, but he dispenses the feedback in small enough doses that someone can absorb it, learn from it, and adjust. He teaches his organization that mistakes are a way of life in the investment business. And how does he respond to mistakes? First, he doesn't panic or assign arbitrary blame. One team member said, "He lets us know that when decisions are collective, the mistakes are collective too. No one person takes the blame." The team then does a post-mortem and learns how to avoid the error a second time. It appears that Ernest understands how to create an environment that best leverages the investments he has made in his people. This might be one factor in his recent promotion to chief executive of Advent in Latin America. Liberator number two, close encounters. Everyone knows Steven Spielberg as an award-winning film director. It is likely that your top 10 movie list includes one of his films. But why are his movies so successful, grossing an average of $156 million per film? Some would posit that it is his creative genius and his ability to tell a story. Others would point to his work ethic. But the active agent may be his ability to elicit more from his crew than other directors do. People who have worked on Spielberg's films say, "You do your best work around him." One way he elicits the best thinking from people is that he knows what people are actually capable of producing. He knows everyone's job intimately, but he doesn't do it for them. He tells them that he has hired them because he admires their work. He uses his knowledge of the job and of their personal capabilities to set a standard for demanding their best work. He comes with strong ideas of his own, but he makes it clear that bad ideas are an okay starting point. He says, "All good ideas start as bad ideas. That's why it takes so long." He establishes an open, creative environment, but he still demands extraordinary work from his team. One of his crew members said, "He expects people to be doing their best, and you know it when you aren't giving your best." And why does Spielberg produce so many successful movies? Because his crew is twice as productive as those of some of the tyrant directors we studied. Because Spielberg creates an environment where people can do their best work, these artists and staff sign up to work with him again and again. In fact, Spielberg typically manages two projects simultaneously, each in different production stages, because his crew stays with him and rolls directly on to the next project. He gets their best work and two times the productivity, and they get to create award-winning films along with him. Liberator number three, a master teacher. Stop and think about the best teachers you've had. Pause for a moment and identify one or two in your mind. What type of learning environment did they create? How much space and freedom of thought did you have? What were the expectations of your performance? In what ways were you stretched and utilized? And how did you actually perform? I ask these questions of a dozen eighth grade students in Mr. Kelly's class. Patrick Kelly is an eighth grade U.S. History and Social Studies teacher at a distinguished California public school. He caught my attention when I learned that every year at middle school graduation ceremony, he not only gets more shout-outs and thank-yous from the graduating students than any other teacher, he gets more than all the other teachers combined. He is more talked about, more loathed, more beloved than any other teacher at the school. Why? I got my first glimpse at the Fall Parent Information Night at La Entrada Middle School. It is one of those nights parents with multiple children dread because, with four children, I have to get to 17 different teachers' classes, many simultaneously, defying laws of physics. My daughter in eighth grade said to me, "Here's my class schedule. Get to as many classes as you can, but be sure to make it to Mr. Kelly's social studies class, and do not be late, and do not talk during his presentation, and do not answer your cell phone, and do not be late. Mom, did you hear me about not being late?" I entered his classroom both scared and intrigued. After the standard 12-minute segment with Mr. Kelly, I left enchanted with eighth grade social studies, ready to quit my job and go back to middle school to learn U.S. history. Why does he affect students and parents alike in such powerful ways? It begins with his classroom environment. He makes it clear that you are there to work hard, to think, and to learn. One student said, "In his class, he doesn't tolerate laziness. You're always working, thinking things over, and seeing your mistakes so you can learn from them." It's a professional and serious environment, which gets lighter and more fun as the students work harder. In this environment, students are encouraged to speak up and voice their opinions. Equal weight is given to asking a good question as answering one of his. Mr. Kelly's expectations for the students' learning are both clear and extremely high. One student said, "He believes that with high expectations come high results. He demands our best. He makes it clear that if we put in our hardest effort, we will succeed." Another said, "He doesn't hide anything from us and lets us know what to improve on. He demands that we work to the best of our ability." No more, no less, just to the best of their ability. There is no homework in his class, nothing assigned, nothing arbitrary. Instead, students are encouraged to do independent study to help them understand the ideas and perform well on tests. The students, having made the choice themselves, do the independent study with zeal. Not all students like Mr. Kelly. Some find him too tough, too demanding, and his expectations unfair compared to other teachers. For students wanting the easy path, his class can be an uncomfortable environment. But most students are engaged by his intelligence and his dedication and thrive under his leadership. They experience his contagious passion and themselves become passionate about civil rights, the U.S. Constitution, and their role in the political process. Patrick Kelly is a multiplier who liberates his students to think and learn. He creates an environment where students can speak out, but where they are required to think and perform at their finest. It won't surprise you that 98% of students in his class score at the proficient or advanced levels on standardized state tests, up from 82% just 3 years ago. A hybrid climate. The secret behind the environment in Mr. Kelly's classroom, and Ernest Bachrach's firm and Steven Spielberg's movie sets, is in a duality we consistently found with liberators. They appear to hold two ostensibly opposing positions with equal fervor. They create both comfort and pressure in the environment. In the eyes of the liberator, it is a just exchange. I give you space, you give me back your best work. Liberators also give people space to make mistakes. They create an environment of learning, but they expect people to learn from the mistakes. It is another fair trade. I give you permission to make mistakes. You have an obligation to learn from the mistakes and not repeat them. The power of liberators emanates from this duality. It isn't enough to just free people's thinking. They create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and their best work. They generate pressure, but they don't generate stress. Liberators operate with a duality much like that of a hybrid car that switches over seamlessly between the electric and the gasoline engine. At low speeds, a hybrid operates in electric mode. At high speeds, it draws on the gasoline to fuel the extra demands on the engine. Such leaders create an open, comfortable environment where people can freely think and contribute. But when more power is needed, they invoke their demanding side that commands only the best performance from others. How do liberators create a safe, open environment, but also relentlessly demand the best thinking and work of those around them? How do they get the full brain power of the organization? Let's turn to the practices of the liberator for answers. The three practices of the liberator. Among the multipliers we studied in our research, we found three common practices. Liberators, 1. Create space, 2. Demand people's best work, and 3. Generate rapid learning cycles. We'll examine each in turn. 1. Create space. Everyone needs space. We need space to contribute and to work. Liberators don't take it for granted that people have the space they need. They deliberately carve out space for others to be able to make a contribution. They do so in the following ways. Release others by restraining yourself. It is a small victory to create space for others to contribute, but it is a huge victory to maintain that space and resist the temptation to jump back in and consume it yourself. This is especially true in formal, hierarchical organizations where people are accustomed to deferring to their leaders. Ray Lane, former president of Oracle Corporation and current managing partner at Kleiner Perkins Venture Capital, is a master at executive restraint. One of his portfolio CEOs remarked, "Ray has learned the importance of restraint in leadership. He knows that less is more, and he never wastes an opinion." When Ray goes on sales calls to meet with executives at a potential client's, two things are certain. One, the client will want to hear from Ray and his vast experience, and two, Ray will be prepared. But despite these forces pulling him in, he holds back. He makes a few opening pleasantries, but he lets the sales team do the deal. Issues come up in conversation that Ray has a point of view about, but still he waits. The sales team, knowing full well that Ray could probably be doing a better job than they, continues their work nonetheless. When they are done, Ray then comes into the conversation. He still doesn't unleash his ideas and give a monologue. He has listened carefully and knows exactly what he wants to add. He dispenses his views in small but intense doses. A longtime colleague of Ray remarked, "He'll often be quiet for long stretches of an important meeting. He listens to what others are saying, and when he does speak, everyone listens." Ray is well known as a brilliant strategist and perhaps one of the most articulate communicators in his business. But instead of overplaying himself and his own ideas, he creates room for others and uses his presence where it can have the greatest potency and impact for the team. Shift the ratio of listening to talking. Liberators are more than just good listeners. They are ferocious listeners. They listen to feed their hunger for knowledge. They listen to learn what other people know and add it to their own reservoir of knowledge. As management guru C.K. Prahalad said to me, "How smart you are is defined by how clearly you can see the intellect of others." They listen intently because they are trying to learn and understand what other people know. John Brandon, one of Apple Incorporated's top sales executives, runs an organization that brings in over $12 billion in revenue each year across three regions of the world. John is a high-energy sales leader and maintains an aggressive travel and meeting schedule, so getting time on his calendar can be tough. But when his direct reports meet with him one-on-one, they get his whole presence. John listens intently to them and is keenly interested in understanding their reality, what is really happening on the ground, with customers and with deals. He asks probing questions that get to the heart of the matter. One of his direct reports said, "The difference with John is not that he listens, it is that he listens to an extreme." In a typical conversation, he spends 80% of the time listening and asking questions. By listening, asking, and probing, John develops an understanding of the realities of the business and an understanding with his team of the opportunities and problems they face. This collective insight into the market has enabled John's organization to experience a phenomenal 375% growth over the last 5 years. John, who can certainly talk a good game himself, knows when it is time to listen. Liberators don't just listen the majority of time. They massively shift the ratio, listening most of the time. This creates space for others to share what they know. Operate consistently. Imagine a troop of young girls competing in double Dutch jump rope. Visualize the smooth, even rhythm of the turning ropes. The turners stand at the rope's ends and rapidly turn the two ropes in opposite directions. Their role is clear and vital, maintain both a consistent arc and a constant speed. Their consistency is what makes it safe for the jumpers to enter the whirling space. Any erratic turns or inconsistency and a jumper can't enter or trips doing so. Consistency creates predictability. When leaders are consistent, it lets others know when they can jump in and allows them to contribute. Operating with consistency is one of the most vital of the practices of the Liberator. In our interviews, we continually heard how multipliers operate with a consistency that enables others. For example, John Brandon was described as comfortable, consistent, confident, relaxed, and disarming. Craig Conway, former CEO of PeopleSoft, took emotion out of every situation. He put a consistently professional front to everything. The consistency of their actions creates two effects. One, it establishes a predictable pattern of behavior. This allows others to know when it is their turn and where there is space for them to contribute. Two, it creates safety. When people operate in predictable ways, we know what to expect and we become comfortable around them. This comfort allows people not only to jump in, but to do so with full power of thought. Recall how Robert Enslin's consistent leadership created a calming effect on his organization. He was able to contain stress instead of flowing it out to the organization. This consistency gave people the platform for transparency and the ability to focus on the real issues, delivering value to SAP customers, which in turn delivered revenue to the corporation. Level the playing field. In any formal organization, the playing field is rarely level, and certain voices are inherently advantaged. These include senior executives, influential thought leaders, critical organizations like product development or sales, and people with deep legacy knowledge. Unless managed, other voices that are perhaps closest to the real issues can become muffled. Liberators amplify these voices to extract maximum intelligence and give advantage to the ideas and voices on the lower end of the playing field. When Nick Riley, the first president and CEO of GM Daewoo Auto and Technology, GMDAT, took the reins, he brought together the American automaker and a very traditional Korean company. He also took explicit steps to level the playing field. Riley created a senior leadership team consisting of 4 Koreans, 3 Europeans, and 4 Americans. Riley, a native of the UK, knew the GM team was likely to dominate. Yet it was clear to him that the success of the operation depended on the team's ability to draw on the talent and intellectual assets of the former Daewoo members. Riley served as an amplifier, establishing systems for drawing out the contributions of the Korean team members, who were all in their mid-50s and initially spoke limited English. He made sure that all executive meetings were simultaneously translated into Korean. At every turn, he showed respect for the Korean team and the legacy Daewoo had built. He asked the Korean team members what aspects of Daewoo's culture needed to be preserved and consequently protected them. He created learning teams by pairing Koreans and non-Koreans to work together and learn from each other. Out of these two cultures, he created a third joint culture based on a set of common values and a level playing field. The team created a new mission, vision, and values for the organization and began to embed them in the Korean operations. Under Riley's leadership, functional silos were reduced, and a company that had been on the brink of liquidation became a major revenue source for General Motors. It also became a hub for global small car design and development, with complete vehicles and kits for assembly at other GM facilities being sold in more than 150 countries worldwide, a 3,000% volume increase in 1 year alone. One senior executive stated, "The way Nick led this joint venture created a higher level of aspiration for all of us." GMDAT is not exempt from the challenges of today's business world and has recently posted a loss, but in October 2009, GM increased its ownership stake in GMDAT to 70.1%, a strong statement of its belief in its Korean unit. Riley now heads GM International Operations and, in October 2009, was named an honorary citizen of Seoul. Liberators begin by creating space, but they do more than create space for others to contribute. Yes, they do provide the space, but they also expect extraordinary work in return. 2. Demand people's best work. Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State under Richard Nixon, was a master at getting people's best work. According to one story, his chief of staff once handed in a report he had written on an aspect of foreign policy. When Kissinger received the report, he asked simply, "Is this your best work?" The chief thought for a moment and, worried that his boss would think the report was not good enough, responded, "Mr. Kissinger, I think I can do better." So Kissinger gave the report back. 2 weeks later, the chief turned in the revised report. Kissinger kept it for a week and then sent it back with a note that said, "Are you sure this is your best work?" Realizing that something must have been missing, the chief once again rewrote the report. This time, when he handed the report to his boss, he said, "Mr. Kissinger, this is my best work." Upon hearing this, Kissinger replied, "Then this time, I will read your report." Here are a few ways that liberators demand the best from those they work with. Defend the standard. Larry Gelwicks, the head coach of Highland Rugby, stood at the center of a huddle of rugby players at the side of the field for the team's first game debrief of the season. Larry asked one question, "Did you give your best?" One player enthusiastically spoke up, "Well, we won, didn't we?" Not unkindly, Larry said, "That's not the question I asked." Another player jumped in, "We just dominated that team. We won 64-20. What more could you ask for?" Larry said, "When you came for tryouts, I said I expected your best. That means your best thinking out there as well as your best physical effort. Is that what you gave today?" One player described one game played on the island of Tonga when he could answer yes to Larry's question. He said, "I had a painful shoulder contusion after a devastating tackle on my opponent. I was ready to quit, ready to let my team down. I couldn't lift my arm, and the pain was excruciating. I remember I began to chant the haka, a traditional Maori war chant, in my head. I remember looking over at the sunset through the palm trees. At that very moment, the game seemed to stop, and I had a choice. A voice told me that I needed to keep going and do my best, not only for myself, but for who I am, and most importantly, for the team, for my brothers." The voice was the recollection of countless practices and games when Coach Gelwick simply asked, "Is that your best?" I finished that game with 2 tries, each the equivalent of a touchdown, becoming the first high school American to score in Tonga. As a manager, you know when someone is below his or her usual performance. What is harder to know is whether people are giving everything they have to give. Asking whether people are giving their best gives them the opportunity to push themselves beyond their previous limits. It is a key reason why people report that multipliers get more than 100% intelligence out of them. Distinguish best work from outcomes. Requiring people's best work is different from insisting on desired outcomes. Stress is created when people are expected to produce outcomes